Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. The 2015 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State were presented on the campuses of Mercer University in Macon and Atlanta, Georgia. This year's lecturer was Alan Brownstein, Professor Emeritus at the UC Davis School of Law. I'm here with Brent Walker, Executive Director of the Baptist Joint Committee. Brent, what made Professor Brownstein a good Sheridan lecturer?
Professor Brownstein is a renowned constitutional scholar, teaches at the University of California, Davis, a good friend of the Baptist Joint Committee and a friend of mine, so we had a good relationship to start with. But he's not only a constitutional scholar in general, but he focuses in on religious liberty issues, on the two clauses in the First Amendment dealing with religious liberty, no establishment and free exercise. So he knows those two clauses backwards and forwards and the many, many court cases that have interpreted them. And he's just a really good guy, a winsome speaker, and he was willing to, you know, travel clear across the continent to visit us in Georgia this year, and we were really grateful for that.
The Sheridan Lectures return to their home, so to speak, at Mercer University every 3 years, but this is the first time that the lectures have been on the Atlanta campus. So can you talk about what was it like venturing to the Atlanta campus for the Sheridan Lectures for the first time?
Well, this is the fourth time that the lectures have been held on the Mercer campus. We had talked from the very beginning about the possibility of maybe sharing time with the Atlanta campus, but we thought it was just a really good opportunity to have a presence at the McAfee School in Atlanta and to share Professor Brownstein with another audience.
You, along with Professor Brownstein and Dean Alan Culpepper of the McAfee School of Theology, had a chance to tour the American Baptist Historical Society archives. So what did you enjoy about that?
Well, that was a lot of fun. You know, those archives historically have been held in Rochester, New York, by the Society, and about 10 years ago they moved them to Atlanta, so it was a real treat to be able to visit them there. Yeah, they had some just wonderful exhibits that they pulled out for us, some original manuscripts from the pen of Isaac Backus, a colonial religious liberty fighter, Baptist preacher in Massachusetts, also was one of the first lobbyists, an original Baptist Joint Committee person. He, on behalf of the Warren Association, lobbied the Continental Congress for religious liberty and separation of church and state. It was a nice adjunct to everything else that we did in Atlanta to be able to visit the Historical Society and to view those items.
Okay, let's listen to the first of three lectures titled Engaging in Respectful Discourse About Religion and Equality.
The subject of my lecture is how we talk about religion and equality. And to introduce my subject, let me describe two alternative paradigms for thinking about speech. The first paradigm understands speech to be a weapon in a power struggle between us and them. Them, the others, the strangers, are different than us in so many ways. They look different. They speak differently. They love differently. They hold very different beliefs about government and God. They can't be reasoned with. They're incorrigible. Under this paradigm, there really isn't any reason for us to talk to the others, the strangers. We only need to talk amongst ourselves about them. We need to talk about them in order to increase and mobilize our political power, so that we can succeed in our political struggles against them. To do that, we have to describe the others, the strangers, as threatening and dangerous. We have to trivialize their needs and concerns. We speak to rally our constituencies so that we will have the power to control and subjugate the others. If we talk to them at all, it should only be for the purpose of negotiating the terms of their surrender. Now, this is a paradigm. It's a model. Perhaps it's an exaggeration. But I think it describes far too much of public discourse today. Moreover, I think this paradigm resonates with us at least some of the time. It does with me. Sometimes I see what people do, and I hear what they say, and I get angry enough to reject the idea of talking to them as people. I just want to shout at them or about them. And let me be clear that there is a place for that kind of speech. Sometimes speech should arouse passions and mobilize constituencies against injustice and tyranny. I don't think the abolitionists should have spoken more softly and respectfully about slavery. I think William Lloyd Garrison was right when he thundered, "I shall be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice, and I will be heard." The problem with this paradigm isn't that it's never appropriate. The paradigm becomes dangerous and debilitating when it begins to dominate all public discourse, when it seems as if all disputes are considered to be as uncompromising a conflict as the struggle against slavery. Now let me describe an alternative model. This paradigm views speech as a tool for building bridges between people who are different from each other. It considers speech to be a way to settle disputes through compromises that require some sharing of costs and benefits. In order to do that, we need to talk to them in a way that allows us to understand the needs and concerns of others, and that also assists them in appreciating our needs and concerns. This kind of discourse allows people to identify the common ground that we share with each other, notwithstanding our ostensible differences. And it's this appreciation of common ground that is the cement with which bridges between people can be built. Now, compared to the first paradigm I described, this alternative paradigm is grounded in a different understanding of the people whom we consider to be strangers and the way that we should relate to them. Part of this understanding is pragmatic. It recognizes that the people we deem to be strangers aren't going away anytime soon. They live here too. Maybe we could ultimately defeat them in a long political struggle, but the cost of that conflict would be extremely high, and there's no guarantee that we would ultimately be victorious. And part of this understanding is normative. The most repeated admonition in the Torah, the Jewish Bible, requires the fair and caring treatment of strangers, because we are told by God, "You know what it is like to be strangers in a strange land." And Christian beliefs express similar sentiments about the treatment of others. And surely, if there is a foundational value on which the American political experiment is based, it is that this is a country where people of different backgrounds and beliefs and experiences and cultures and orientations can live and work together. America is a place where our differences enrich us rather than divide and diminish us. So I think there are good reasons to consider this alternative model. But it's not the purpose of my talk today to try to convince you to adopt this approach to public discourse. I'm a church-state scholar. I'm not a member of the clergy whom you've chosen to help you with moral issues. I tell my law students back home that it's not my job to tell them what their values should be. And that's certainly true today as well. You have to look to your own hearts and minds to decide the purpose of your own speech. The purpose of my talk today is more expedient. There are two roads here, and one is more difficult to travel on than the other. It is very easy to speak out in the first model, to express cheerleading speech, rally round the flag speech, speech that places ourselves on a pedestal and demonizes the stranger. No one needs to hear a lecture to learn how to do that. And if you speak that way, the rewards you will receive from people who agree with you will be quick and plentiful. It's hard to pursue the alternative model successfully. Speaking respectfully in a way that builds bridges is difficult. And that's what my lecture today is about. If you want to talk respectfully, I think I may be able to help you do that. At least I'm going to try to help you do that for the next 35 minutes or so. First, it's important to understand that the bridge you're trying to construct is a two-way street. Your needs and concerns are part of the discussion, too. When I talk about respectful discourse, I'm talking about speech that not only respects the person you're talking to, but that also encourages respect for you as well. Part of respectful discourse is talking in a way that allows you to understand the other person. And part of respectful discourse is figuring out the best way to talk so that the other person can understand you. I'm going to describe several general ideas about respectful discourse. Then I'm going to apply those ideas to discussion of two problematic areas, two controversial areas. One is how to talk about religious liberty and equality, the conflict between religious and non-religious people. And two, how to talk about religious liberty and same-sex marriage, gender equality, and discrimination against gays and lesbians. So let me talk about some general principles first. The core idea underlying respectful discourse is the search for common ground between individuals and groups. That's what bridge building requires. Indeed, it's what all persuasive speech requires. There has to be some common interest and understanding between people that can serve as the foundation for meaningful discussions on issues where people disagree. But a lot of contemporary American discourse creates insurmountable obstacles for finding common ground between religious people and non-religious people, and between some religious people and gays and lesbians. In respectful discourse, you cannot use language or arguments that suggest that the other, the stranger, doesn't exist. You cannot make arguments that suggest that others or strangers just don't matter, and that concerns never need to be taken into account. Perhaps that should be obvious, but it's a rule that's frequently transgressed today. More commonly, speakers often just fail to take the needs and interests of others seriously. If we trivialize what is important to others, we see no need to even try to accommodate the other's concerns. Now, taking the concerns of others seriously doesn't mean that we will always have to accommodate the other person's demands. What it does mean is that we will have to acknowledge the costs, the pain that a compromise may require of others. Also, respectful discourse avoids defining people by one single characteristic. We can't find common ground if we ignore the complexity of human needs and values. If we define people solely in terms of one aspect of their identity, an aspect we typically don't share. Similarly, we need to avoid pigeonholing people by by assuming that if they have one characteristic or hold one belief, then they necessarily must have other attributes and hold additional beliefs. Respectful discourse recognizes the unique complexity of the other. Respectful discourse in a society with some commitment to personal liberty recognizes that, at least to some extent, we all have the right to act wrongly in the eyes of others. The right to act wrongly in the eyes of others. This is one of the primary principles which separates the two speech paradigms I described earlier. For those who see speech solely as a weapon of ideological warfare, there is never a right to act wrongly. Also, while you're trying to understand what it's like to walk in the other person's shoes, talk about what's important to you in a way that resonates with what is important to the other person. Help them to appreciate what it's like to walk in your shoes. Remember, the goal is mutually respectful discourse. You deserve to be treated with respect, just as the people you are addressing or discussing deserve to be treated with respect as well. These are my general ideas and suggestions. Now let's talk about how they apply to the two areas of discourse that are the focus of my lecture. And we can begin with talking respectfully about religious liberty and equality in conversations between religious and non-religious individuals. And discussions about religious liberty and equality have become increasingly politicized in our society. We hear far too many generalizations. Conservatives care about religious liberty. Liberals don't. Liberals care about non-Christians, members of minority faiths, and non-religious people. Conservatives don't. These kinds of comments suggest that liberals who care about religious liberty and conservatives who respect non-Christians and the non-religious and who care about religious equality don't exist. Too often, we ignore the complex beliefs of both liberals and conservatives and pigeonhole both groups into ill-fitting ideological straitjackets. And here it's important to recognize that people who really understand and believe in the separation of church and state can be extremely effective bridge builders in today's polarized environment. Today, some conservatives support the rigorous enforcement of free exercise rights to prevent government from interfering with religion. But they oppose any kind of meaningful enforcement of Establishment Clause principles to restrain government when it tries to promote religion. And some liberals support the rigorous enforcement of Establishment Clause principles, restricting the government's promotion of religion. But they oppose any serious enforcement of free exercise rights, either through constitutional or statutory law. Someone committed to the separation of church and state, however, understands the need to have both religion clauses treated seriously. Separationists understand that the two religion clauses may sometimes be in tension with each other, but each one also reinforces the other in important ways. We believe we jeopardize both religious liberty and religious equality when the government unacceptably interferes with religion and when government unacceptably promotes religion. People who hold these beliefs can help build bridges between conservatives and liberals on church-state issues because they share common ground with both groups. And common ground is the foundation for respectful and persuasive dialogue. Conservatives can't dismiss you out of hand because they respect your commitment to free exercise rights. And liberals can't dismiss you out of hand either because they respect your commitment to Establishment Clause values. And if our goal is respectful bridge-building discourse about religious liberty and equality between religious and non-religious people, some comments are obviously dysfunctional and unhelpful. For example, religious speakers build walls rather than bridges if they argue that non-religious people are necessarily immoral and can't be trusted to live by an ethical code. Put aside for the moment the fact that this statement is blatantly false, it also defines people by one characteristic. They are not religious, and presumes that they necessarily have, or in this case lack, other attributes and qualities. Secular speakers create barriers rather than bridges when they characterize religious beliefs as fairy tales and argue that religious beliefs are completely mutable and changeable. If a law penalizes a religious practice, a secular speaker might argue, religious individuals can just change their practice to conform to the law, just like they change clothes from one day to the next. This kind of an argument trivializes the needs and values of religious people. It tells them that burdening religious practice imposes no cost on anyone that need to be taken into account. So there are lots of ways to build barriers and fences. And we see discourse that does that all the time. How do we engage in respectful discourse that builds bridges instead? Where is the common ground between religious and non-religious people on which we can create human conditions so we can hear the other and be heard by him or her? Well, one common ground is fear. I think it's important to acknowledge a fundamental obstacle to respectful interactions is the fear that people in our society have of others, of strangers, of people who believe differently than we do. Both religious and non-religious people have two fears that need to be addressed. One fear is that they will be excluded from meaningful participation in public discourse that shapes public policy. Secular persons worry that if religious beliefs and arguments are part of public discourse and public policy debate, then important government decisions will be based on principles and values and ideas that they think are inaccessible to them. The non-religious person can't authentically argue the meaning of scripture because they don't believe in it. If that's the basis on which laws are adopted, they will feel as if they are being ruled by a foreign sovereign. The religious person experiences similar anxiety. Their religious beliefs are the source and the foundation of their values and policy judgments. If they can't bring these ideas forward in public debate and use them to influence government policy decisions, then their voice will be distorted at best, if not entirely silenced. Respectful discourse recognizes that these fears are genuine. They can't be dismissed lightly. They need to be acknowledged and appreciated before they can be addressed. Only then can religious and non-religious people talk about how they can mitigate their concerns. A second fear experienced by religious and non-religious people is that the other side, is trying to change who you are. The pressure to change is both cultural and legal. As a cultural matter, non-religious people feel that they are relentlessly pressured to change their beliefs. They are repeatedly subject to proselytizing, both directly and indirectly. Religious people feel that the secular identity of government institutions relentlessly reinforces a message proclaiming the irrelevancy of religion. And there's also the even greater fear that the other side will use the power of law to force conformity to their beliefs. here. On one side, the fear is that a secular government will force religious people to violate the obligations of their faith. The law will not recognize the need to accommodate religious practice and belief. And on the other side, the fear is that non-religious people will be forced to live according to religious mandates that stifle their individuality and freedom. Here again, I think the first step to respectful and meaningful dialogue is to recognize that these fears exist and that they are not trivial concerns. But with some trepidation, I'd like to offer two suggestions as to how religious and non-religious people can find common ground in talking to and about each other. First, an important step toward respectful discourse is to recognize that the essence of liberty is the right to be different and to act wrongly in the eyes of others. This is true of all of our core freedoms, including freedom of religion and freedom of speech. In a free society, we recognize the right of others to express the wrong messages and to worship the wrong God, or not to worship God at all. We recognize these rights not because we believe that bad speech or the following of false faiths has no consequences. Both may have serious consequences. We protect the right of others to act wrongly in our eyes in part because that's the foundation for protecting our right to act wrongly in their eyes. And this realization can serve as a common ground for respectful discourse between religious and non-religious people. Religious liberty recognizes the deeply felt need of individuals to determine religious truth for themselves. The right to live one's life authentically in accordance with one's religious or non-religious identity. My second suggestion addresses the problem of trying to explain and justify the need for religious exemptions and accommodations to non-religious people. Non-religious people often view distinctive treatment for religion as a costly and unjustified privilege that benefits religious groups at the expense of others. Now, the conventional justification for religious accommodations goes something like this. Religious believers have a relationship with God, and duties arise out of that relationship. The source of these duties is the relationship between sovereign and subject, between the lawgiver, the author of a higher law, and the subject who are bound by it. We need to create religious exemptions from laws that require people to violate their faith, because it isn't fair to place religious believers in the untenable position of having to violate either civil law or the obligations imposed on them by a divine sovereign. Now, I think this argument is unpersuasive to many non-religious people. The problem isn't only that they dispute the existence of a higher law. It's that non-religious people often see arguments about divine mandates that supersede civil law as a threat to their own freedom. They think, if religious people believe that they can correctly determine religious truth and that this truth trumps civil law, then what stops religious people from imposing these religious obligations on non-adherents? Now, I'm not suggesting that there's anything intrinsically wrong about the argument I just described about divine sovereignty. My point is that this argument may not explain religious liberty in a way that resonates with non-religious people. It doesn't relate to anything that's important to them. And in fact, it frightens them. I think there's another way to talk about the relationship between the believer and God and the duties that arise out of that relationship. We can describe this relationship as one that is based not only on hierarchy, but also on love. Christians and Jews are told to live God with all their hearts and souls. And under this approach, we can recast the argument about the religious believer being torn between conflicting obligations owed to the state and to God. But now the duties owed to God arise out of a relationship based on love rather than sovereignty. I think there are several reasons why this argument for religious accommodations may share more of a common ground with non-religious people. First, we all recognize that obligations arise out of bonds of love and affection. Anyone who's a member of a family knows this, and we've experienced the conflict that these duties can create. Respect for personal commitments to others based on love and affection extend far beyond religious commitments. So there's common ground here based on common shared experience. Second, love is personal and subjective. If A loves B, I don't need to share those feelings or to believe that B is worthy of A's love to recognize the strength of the obligations that arise out of the relationship. Third, love is a less threatening basis for a duty-creating relationship for a person who isn't part of the relationship. The consequence for breaching obligations ground on affection is the loss of the relationship. The sundering of one's relationship to God may be a dreadful consequence for religious believers, but it isn't frightening to non-religious people who don't experience that relationship in the first place. And fourth and finally, describing religious duties as grounded in love is less threatening for another reason. It's reasonable to worry that loyalty and duties to a sovereign may be coerced, but love is intrinsically voluntary. Loving relationships only have the power to obligate us because they're based on voluntary commitments. And before I move on, I have to take a drink. For the remainder of my lecture, I want to discuss respectful discourse involving religion and gender equality and marriage equality for same-sex couples. And regrettably, respectful discourse on these topics is extremely rare today. You only have to have been reading the papers for the last 2 weeks. For example, the recently decided Hobby Lobby case was a disaster for anyone hoping to encourage respectful discourse relating to religious liberty and gender equality. Legal scholars angrily debated the merits of this dispute. And when I say angrily, I mean angrily. Few people even tried to find enough common ground to begin a temperate discussion of this case. Most commentators ignored all of the principles that I've described to you today. Let me give you just one example, and it's one of many. Both sides worked really hard to trivialize the interests of the other side. Gender equality advocates who opposed an accommodation insisted that the religious liberty interests of the owners of Hobby Lobby were negligible and too attenuated to require any protection whatsoever. They said it makes no sense for an employer to claim that it's complicit in the sinful conduct of abortion because it provided a health insurance plan to employees that included contraceptives that arguably operated as abortifacients. Now, I think this argument is wrong on the merits. But merits aside, you can't engage in respectful discourse by insisting that what is most important to others deserves no respect whatsoever. Many proponents of Hobby Lobby's claims were equally disrespectful in derogating the government's public health interest in providing adequate medical insurance coverage to female employees. Access to the contraceptives at issue was dismissed as unnecessary, easily paid for by the employees themselves. And here again, denigrating what is important to others diminished any possibility of finding common ground solutions to this dispute. Respectful discourse attempting to bridge differences would approach this dispute very differently. It would start from the position that there is something of value on both sides of this conflict. And then the discussion could move forward to try to develop solutions that would protect religious liberty to the extent possible while mitigating or spreading the cost to female employees of providing an accommodation to religious employers. Unfortunately, many advocates in this contentious debate never meaningfully addressed this possibility because of the way that they initially presented their arguments. Let me give you another example of how a dispute involving religious liberty and gender equality might be discussed in a way that helps one side to understand and appreciate the concerns of the other side. There's a case on the West Coast involving a pharmacist who refuses on religious grounds to sell a contraceptive drug called Plan B, the so-called morning after pill. Let's put the technical legal issues in the case aside. How can advocates supporting religious liberty respectfully discuss this case in a way that builds bridges on common ground between adversaries? When I talk about this case, often to very liberal audiences, I start by acknowledging the importance of women having access to pharmaceuticals, including contraceptives. And I acknowledge their legitimate concern that religious accommodations might hamper access to medicine that women need and have a lawful right to purchase. But then I ask if my audience would consider the other side. First, I explain that freedom of conscience parallels freedom of speech in an important respect. Just as we protect speech, even when we strongly disagree with the speaker's message, we protect rights of conscience, even when we strongly disagree with the beliefs of the person asserting this right. We don't just protect good speech or good acts of conscience. For these rights to be meaningful, we have to protect them, even when others are acting wrongfully in our eyes. Second, I offer a hypothetical to the audience. Suppose a particular drug is manufactured in a third world country under horrendous working conditions. The factory workers making this drug are treated almost like slaves. They receive starvation wages. The workplace where the drug is produced is deplorably unsafe. And now assume a pharmacist refuses to stock the drug. He believes that it would violate his conscience to be part of the chain of distribution, marketing a product that was produced in such an unconscionable way. Should we accommodate the conscientious objection of this pharmacist, as long as people who need the drug have accessible alternative supplies of it available to them? Now, I don't suggest that the above arguments necessarily change people's minds about an accommodation for pharmacists who object to selling Plan B on religious grounds. But they do create a shared foundation for a respectful discussion of this dispute. Now let me turn to discourse about religion and marriage equality and discrimination against gays and lesbians. And once again, sadly, it's easy to identify disrespectful discourse that creates barriers between some religious people and the LGBT community. When religious opponents of same-sex marriage argue that the state's interest in the welfare of children requires that marriage must be between a man and a woman, gay and lesbian parents experience these comments as denying the existence of their families. It's impossible to find common ground if you act as if the others don't exist. And arguments that trivialize what is important to others are also inherently disrespectful. When a religious opponent of same-sex marriage dismisses the long-term intimate relationship and commitments of a gay or lesbian couple as a mere lifestyle choice, there can be no basis for meaningful dialogue. Similarly, when advocates for gay and lesbian rights suggest that religious beliefs are not immutable and that devoutly religious people can simply decide not to obey the dictates of their faith, there's no foundation for mutual understanding. Religion is no more an easily discarded lifestyle than is the expression of one's orientation towards sexual intimacy and association. Treating either as a lifestyle that can be changed without cost is inherently disrespectful. Contemporary discussions about religion and equality rights for gays and lesbians often involve each side defining the other in terms of a single characteristic. And that's inherently disrespectful. It's one thing to recognize that a particular characteristic or belief is important to others. It's something else entirely to ignore the complexity of the human condition and to act as if that one belief or characteristic encompasses the totality of another person or group's value or humanity. Several years ago, there was extended debate in my hometown, as there was in many communities, about the Boy Scouts' decision to refuse to accept gay young men as scouts. Both sides complained that they were being unfairly characterized by their opponents. The scouts complained that their critics ignored all the positive things that the Boy Scouts did for their members and the community at large. They said, it's as if all of scouting can be defined and encompassed by one discriminatory policy. Advocates for gay rights argued that the scouts demeaned gay young men by focusing on their sexual orientation and ignoring everything else about them. A gay young man could be more trustworthy, loyal, brave, helpful, and the rest of the code, than anyone else in the troop. But the scouts couldn't see anything beyond the young man's sexual orientation. Now, both sides were correct that they were being defined inappropriately by a single characteristic that ignored all of their other qualities. But both sides had real trouble recognizing that they were both doing the exact same thing as the other side, and that doing so prevented them from finding common ground on which respectful discourse might be based. Now, I do not suggest that discourse about religion and same-sex marriage and gay rights will be easy or comfortable for everyone. But I do think there is enough common ground to create the possibility of respectful discourse and some mutual understanding. Indeed, I think there's a lot of common ground here. To begin with, we can return to the basic principle that I've mentioned repeatedly in my talk. Foundation for personal liberty in a diverse society is the recognition that people must have some right to act wrongly in the eyes of others. We may have the right to express the wrong speech, worship the wrong God, and marry the wrong partner. Moreover, there are specific common grounds that link religious liberty and the rights of same-sex couples to marry. Both religious liberty rights and the right of same-sex couples to marry are based on a commitment to personal autonomy, the right to live one's life in a way that authentically expresses one's identity. These rights aren't mere preferences. They involve core aspects of a person's humanity and sense of self. There may be shared common ground in recognizing that it is equally unrealistic and unacceptable to insist that gays and lesbians should just stop being gay, or that devoutly religious persons should just instantaneously stop obeying the dictates of their faith. Also, religion and sexual orientation have a merged identity and conduct dimension to them. Religious belief and practice can't be separated. It makes little sense to tell Catholics, for example, that we will protect their right to their religious identity, but prohibit them from practicing Catholicism. And there's a similar weakness in arguing that we will protect gays and lesbians from discrimination based on their orientation, but will prohibit their right to sexual intimacy and marriage. Further, both religious liberty and the right to marry reflect respect for relational commitments and responsibilities. Religious people want to have the liberty to fulfill the responsibilities that arise out of their relationship with God. Same-sex couples want to marry to express their commitment to the person with whom they want to share their lives and to fulfill the responsibilities that arise out of that relationship. And finally, there's a striking parallel between the arguments raised against protecting religious liberty and the arguments raised against recognizing the right of same-sex couples to marry. Both rights are challenged on the ground that they create steep and limitless slippery slopes with no stopping place. Indeed, opponents of religious liberty rights have argued that protecting this right would require society to protect the right to engage in religiously motivated polygamous relationships. And the same argument has been offered to deny same-sex couples the right to marry. Now, recognizing common ground doesn't guarantee results. It doesn't guarantee that religious communities that oppose same-sex marriage and proponents of marriage equality will be able to work out acceptable compromises involving religious liberty and the right of same-sex couples to marry. Can't guarantee results. I only suggest that respectful discourse attempting to build bridges between people who are strangers to each other may allow meaningful conversations to begin. And in today's heated and polarized areas of life and law, knowing how to begin a conversation, that's no small matter. Thank you.
That was Professor Alan Brownstein delivering the Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State, recorded live at Mercer University. Thanks for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more on the Sheridan Lectures, including videos of this and previous year's presentations, visit bjconline.org/lectures. For more podcasts, go to bjconline.org/podcasts.